Hello and welcome to this month's session of CIO Live. My name is Kiran Ganesh, Head of Investment Communications here in the Chief Investment Office at UBS. Markets have stayed pretty resilient through the summer. There's been very robust corporate earnings growth and continued investment in artificial intelligence. But there's still a lot going on and a lot to keep things interesting. We've seen rotations between sectors, geopolitical uncertainty, uncertainty about the path to interest rates, and then more recently also increasing long-term bond yields, also grabbing some of the headlines. So to discuss what some of all of this will mean for markets and for portfolios, I'm really happy to be joined today by our US economist, Andrew Dubinsky, our head of fixed income strategy, Fred Mellers, and our head of European equities, Rolf Ganter. As we go along and as the discussion evolves with our guests, please do send through any questions that you might have. I'll try to put as many of those to the panelists towards the end of the call. Andrew, why don't we start with you, and we'll get into some of the questions around interest rates a bit later, but maybe it's best to start with how you're assessing the overall US economic picture right now.
Yes, no, I'd be happy to. So we'll start with growth. And I think the main message is growth in the first half was quite solid, particularly, and if you focus on the private side of the economy, you could describe it as even quite strong. And that's the red bars are looking at what was happening with private spending from consumers and businesses, and it averaged around 3% for the first half. So pretty good. So despite the energy headwinds, we had a number of other positive forces really offset those headwinds. And so one of them is, of course, we had the tax cuts in the first half of the year. We've had around $9 trillion year over year of wealth gains, mostly from the stock market. And we've had pretty steady support from AI CapEx as well. So one key negative, but many positives offsetting that. And as we look to the second half, I would expect more support from the CapEx side to continue support from the wealth effects, maybe to a lesser extent. So you're going to continue to see growth probably stay around 2%. I would just say maybe there's a little bit of a ceiling on growth that's coming from the slowing of the jobs market, and the starting point on income growth is not particularly great, but not weak enough to derail this, I would say, near-term growth outlook continuing. So very, I would say, modest recession risk, and nothing really to concern policymakers from a growth side. And I'll dive into the go ahead.
Yeah, maybe just to jump in on the growth side of things. So you mentioned that the AI CapEx. So I know a question that we've had, you know, from a lot of clients is, you know, to what extent is that propping up the growth? Have you got sort of any views on the, you know, to what extent this growth picture is reliant on AI? Is it just a contributor? Is it like the only thing that's happening? Sort of any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so it's definitely, I would say, one of the key pillars for growth. And I think there's, you know, wide range of estimates about how much people would attribute to it. But I think the way we would count the AI contributions would be from the direct and the indirect channels. And so the chart on the right is trying to size up the direct contribution that we get from the investment side. So there's a lot of equipment spending, a lot of software spending, and a smaller extent of structure spending. And that's what those gray bars show, is that we're getting, let's say, 6 to 8 tenths annualized on average in every quarter from that investment. Now, we're also importing a lot of those products. So there's an offsetting import effect. So the net, I would say, direct contribution is around 0.5 percentage point. So if growth in the first half of the year was just a little bit under 2%, you know, 1/2 is, you know, we'll call it a quarter. Now, I do think there's some other indirect parts that we're getting from the stock market and the wealth gain. So that's possibly adding another couple tenths. So altogether, we're talking about, let's say, 6 to 7 tenths or so of growth just really coming from the AI theme. So if the AI theme slows down, we would have a pretty big deceleration in growth. So clearly a really big theme.
Brilliant. Thanks, Andrew. But I guess also reassuring is not the only thing happening, which, you know, I think sometimes if you look at the headlines, it feels that way. Why don't I just let you continue and looking at the, I guess, the inflation picture and then, yeah, what that might mean for the Fed.
Yeah, so I think the good news for the U.S. economy is the growth side. And I think the bad news is, inflation still remains pretty elevated. And it's really the key driver for the policy outlook. So I'd say, the near term good news is that the peak in headline inflation and in core inflation is likely behind us. And so we've had a couple months where inflation is going in the right direction. So I'll call, June and July data. And that has definitely helped weaken the case from the hawks to possibly consider hiking. And that combined with the softer jobs data has been one reason why we've seen a decline in the pricing for near-term hikes. So the key thing is, the middle line is core PCE, and I would say that's the measure of these inflation measures that the Fed puts the most weight on, and we're at 3.3%, and that's clearly too high. And if I had to attribute why is it so elevated, a big part of that is from tariff effects. So maybe 8/10 of the extra 130 is coming from one key theme. And the good news is over the past few months, we've seen some improvements in goods inflation, consistent with the idea that the tariff effects are mostly behind us. I would say the concerning thing for the outlook is we still have risk to the upside from coming from the conflict and coming from AI demand linked inflation, as we were talking about in the prior page. So AI demand inflation definitely is a theme, is possibly adding to possibly up to 5/10 of extra inflation, and that is to some extent partially offsetting the disinflation trends that we're getting from the tariff story rolling out. Now, in terms of what matters going forward is, do we see further improvements in core inflation? That's our expectation. And do we see expectations in both the inflation swap market and in surveys, do they remain fairly contained? And we think as long as we get both of those conditions, we'll see the Fed staying on hold through into 2027. But it's certainly the key thing to watch. And obviously we watch the communication very closely just to see what signposts or what level of inflation is just too uncomfortable for the Fed, where they might be less patient about watching things slowly return to target.
Brilliant, thank you, Andrew. So the Fed staying on hold through 2026 and into next year. Of course, that's super important for the path for, I guess, short-term rates. So Fred, coming on to you, further out on the yield curve, we've seen yields rising over the past few weeks. Perhaps you could talk us through some of what's been driving that, and what do you think about the outlook, both for the level of yields from here, but also the shape of the yield curve?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Kieran, and thanks for having me on today. So look, as Andrew touched on, growth, inflation, central bank policy is and always has been the primary driver of long-term interest rates, and expectations around the future path of central bank policy is obviously incredibly important. But in the last few weeks, life has got pretty exciting for us bond nerds, because as Andrew also said, there hasn't been a lot of change in central bank expectations, particularly for the Fed. Things have been quite stable. In fact, you've seen a bit of a dialing back of rate hike expectations. But as you touched on, Kieran, long-term interest rates have moved up quite sharply. And I guess, like everything in life, it's complicated. There's many reasons for these recent moves. I think we can probably break it down to four main reasons. The first one is we obviously have a new Fed chair. Kevin Warsh wants to make some changes in terms of how the Fed conducts monetary policy. One such change is around communication. He wants the Fed to communicate less. He's also been quite vocal on wanting the Fed to have a smaller balance sheet and less of a footprint in markets. So with that sort of change forthcoming, We're seeing a lot more kind of risk premia getting priced into the long end of the curve outside of any changes in central bank expectations. Secondly, as you can see in my first slide here, the US fiscal situation has obviously come back into focus. It's quite interesting because as you can see, the deficit hasn't really changed too much over the last few months. It's still hovering a little bit over 6%. But investors have obviously got more concerned in recent days and weeks that nothing's going to change here. We have some November midterm elections coming up, and it's highly unlikely that you're going to see any change in terms of fiscal policy, any changes, any fiscal consolidation. So what that means is the market is going to continue to see large amounts of government bond supply coming. And as such, the market wants a little bit more term premium. Thirdly, it was just talked about AI CapEx. The recent earnings season out of the US, it became pretty clear that there's absolutely no intention to dial back these CapEx plans for AI. In fact, they're going up. Because the amounts of money that these companies are looking to spend are so large, a lot of the funding is now being sourced out of the debt capital markets. So for a number of months now, we're seeing a lot of corporate bonds being issued from large US tech companies, and they're issuing across the curve. They're issuing duration into the market. And, you know, our observation is they're not too price sensitive because their balance sheets are so strong. They're sitting on a lot of cash. They're not very levered. They're willing to pay up on the credit side in order to access debt financing. So you have a lot of supply coming. And with the outlook for more CapEx to come going into next year, the bond investors are getting increasingly more sensitive to the supply that's coming. And that leads to the fourth reason. Over the last few years, we have seen a lot of official sector buying being reduced from the bond market. And it's becoming more and more important for private sector investors to step in and absorb all this supply. And private sector investors are obviously a lot more sensitive. So even if fundamentals are in a good place, supply is obviously a sensitive factor for private sector investors. So we think those four factors have been a key reason for the backup in the long end. And to conclude, ultimately, we think the market has probably gone a little bit too far too fast. As Andrew touched on, we still have expectations that the Fed does not raise interest rates this year. Inflation has been moderating. So for us, we think that there's actually a lot of great value in fixed income markets at the moment.
Brilliant. Thank you. Thank you, Fred. I mean, you mentioned some of the rising government debt and no sign of that changing. Does that change how investors should think about investing in fixed income over the longer term?
Yeah, look, debt sustainability is obviously a key issue and something investors should be well aware of. It makes the headlines sporadically as it is at the moment. I'd say there's, you know, been a lot of bearishness around fixed income for a number of years now, not so much because of the US fiscal situation, but more so due to the fact that inflation has been elevated and central banks have been unable to hit their inflation targets for now nearly 5 years. So I think inflation is more of an issue for fixed income than maybe the fiscal backdrop, particularly when we think about the United States. We are going to see, we believe, more unorthodox policies coming in order to keep nominal interest rates stable and down. For instance, last week, we saw the US Treasury Department increase the amount of buybacks that they're doing in the long end of the curve. They have for some time been skewing their funding more to the front end. They are opening up more international swap facilities to ensure that foreign central banks can access dollars and they don't need to go and sell US dollar collateral. We're also seeing changes in regulation. So there's an increasing amount of unorthodox policy coming, which is a clear signal that policymakers are getting increasingly uncomfortable with the level of interest rates. So what that means is you have to be very courageous to trade against that. The exit valve for, you know, ongoing worsening fiscal backdrops is probably going to be more expressed through the currency channel than the rate channel, because at the end of the day, policymakers have a lot of tools available to essentially keep a lid on interest rates. So bottom line is, we think there's a lot of bearishness out there in the fixed income markets at the moment, but yields are historically high. As you can see on the next slide, there is a lot baked in terms of the forward path of policy rates. So if you zoom into the US, you can see that the market is already priced for essentially two rate hikes over the next year. We think the Fed is on hold at the moment. So that's where we see the opportunity. In addition to that, you really need to model some aggressive risk scenarios to lose money on fixed income, particularly relative to cash. You have to think about market expectations moving beyond the current two hikes that are in the curve. You need to think about another 100, 150 basis points of rate hikes from the Fed. Now, we're humble enough to admit that anything is possible, but given the macro backdrop at the moment, that is very different to, say, 2022, when the Fed did an aggressive sequence of rate hikes, we think there's real value there, and you get compensated at the current level of rates.
Brilliant. Thank you, Fred. We're going to move the conversation on to equities now and with you, Rolf. Europe is starting to deliver returns at last, and you've recently upgraded European equities to attractive. Perhaps you could talk us through what's behind the more positive outcomes we're seeing, but also behind your more positive view.
Yes, sure, Karen. And look, Fred said before, life is complicated. So let's talk about Europe, right? As we all know, a pretty complicated place, but I think it's important to know if we as CIO and UBS talk about Europe, we're not talking about investing in Europe. We're talking about investing in European companies. And that is for us a big, big difference. Why is that? Because look, every race, and if you go on the next page here, every race starts a little bit with the first step or the first lap or whatever you want to describe it. And clearly, when you look, I mean, Europe has been through tremendous challenges, tremendous, you know, issues, and still not everything is solved, that's for sure. But when you look how companies, how they reacted, how did CEOs, CFOs, the board, what did they do? I mean, they used this chance to get really, I call it lean and mean. That means like really, while the US was focusing on revenue growth and all the beautiful structural trends, Europe was actually streamlining and taking really looking where can we further reduce, where can we optimize, etc. And then just think a little bit. Now, what you see here, it has been like over the last few quarters, and you see that you know, there was a continuous disappointment and analysts downgraded their earnings. And now, as I said, right, every race starts with the first lap. You see now the first time that we actually turn positive in terms of the we call it the end of the downgrade cycle. And that really made us believe now it's time to look at Europe from a more cyclical point of view, but also a structural. And that's why we upgrade Europe here. And this means Europe, the Eurozone, and by the way, also banks, I think we can touch on in a second as well, on the 16th of July. What should investors be aware? It's an investment-led and not a consumer-led recovery. And clearly, we have a lot of good things here in Europe as well. And for us, the proof was really in Q2, we got around 22% earnings growth, which is fantastic for Europe. And also 58% really of the companies beating estimates, and just 33% are disappointed. And that is really something we really, really like. And also, I mean, Fred mentioned, right, talked about debt sustainability. Look, Germany has the budget, and you saw it before, and the Eurozone, so for all the infrastructure spending, for all the defense spending, so it's not only cyclical, but also structural. I think Europe, there's now a case to look at this region.
Brilliant. Thank you, Rolf. Great signs on this earnings momentum that we can see here. How sustainable do you think that is?
Actually, you know, the most expensive things is this time it's different. But clearly, when we look, and you see that here on the right page, in terms of how, you know, the Eurostox 50 index performed, and you see also here our earnings estimates. And if we just go back a couple of weeks, actually the beginning of the year, we thought about, you know, combined 26, 27, we're going to see around 25% accumulated earnings growth. Now we just upgraded a few days ago and said, look, we see 15% this year, 15% next year. So it's already 32% if you take the effect into account. And also for 2028, we are conservatively assuming around 10%. So we really believe it's coming through. And why it's coming through? You know, general thing is about the broadening economy. But as I said, right, they took costs out. Now you see the leading indicator stabilizing. So if you add on an improving side on the economy, so PMI is coming nicely in, you know, we see expansion again, then you get not the double whammy, but you get the double benefits. Low costs, revenue growth coming in. That makes us confident that really there is some place and some sustainability to look at Europe. And by the way, don't forget, we are trading in Europe around Eurozone around 16 times PE, next year around 14, 14 and a half times PE. We're also talking about a very reasonable evaluation levels. And that's why we also increased, by the way, the index targets to around 7,100 for next year. June, that's around 10%. You get dividends as well. So we're quite confident about that.
Brilliant. Thanks, Rolf. We've got a global audience here, people watching in Europe, people watching in the US, maybe some night owls in Asia, or those going to watch the replay in Asia as well. You know, maybe some have, you know, either overlooked Europe or sort of chosen to look to other places, given some of the underperformance over the past decade. For people coming afresh at this market, how do you think they should position it in the context of their broader portfolios?
Yeah, let's take a balanced portfolio. You have 50% equity. So I think the euro or Europe overall should probably represent around 14% of that. So an overall 5% in an overall portfolio of European equities is certainly not a bad start. Now, what would I look at, or what would we look at when we look at Europe? Clearly, I would look at areas where Europe is actually strong, where we have an edge. That means, like, when you look a little bit thematically as well, I mean, we talk about European leaders, as I mentioned before, defense, infrastructure. I mean, you know, we have these transformational innovation opportunities, trios, AI, power and resources, and longevity. Now, where do we fit in? Well, actually, in power and resource, a lot of industrial companies provide hardware and also software, clearly, as well. But power, you know, these kind of structural trends. When we look into AI, we also, by the way, upgraded the IT sector in Europe. Investors should be aware, when you talk about IT in Europe, around 55% of it are actually names exposed to the CapEx cycle, to really the semi-cap equipment. So the area we like. So this is when you look at the European IT. And also think about, like, longevity, and think about, you know, it's called, you know, now luxury and lifestyle, the theme we have here as well. Lifestyle, longevity. We have a lot of high-end luxury names, lifestyle names, where also offer here interesting opportunities. And as we are based in Switzerland, we like also chocolate, right? So think also a little bit about, you know, niches of companies. We Swiss mid-caps, we just put in focus now as well, which have, like, really niches, highly profitable, strong growth. These are areas when you look at a European overview.
Thank you, Ross. So yeah, great macro story and a lot of specific opportunities there as well. I'm going to turn on to some of the questions we've been getting in. Quite a few around yield, but I think, Fred, you covered most of those in your answer. So I'm going to turn to one just on the debt. U.S. federal debt passed $40 trillion recently. Interest payments now the second largest federal government expense. Andrew, maybe first to you on how that might be managed to sort of government level, and then Fred, perhaps, you know, you were mentioning a toolkit on how they could deal with this, perhaps you could expand on that. So yeah, Andrew, why don't we just start with your perspectives on the scale of the debt and how the US might manage that.
Yeah, so I think, you know, as Fred mentioned, the direction for deficits has really not changed that much recently. If anything, on the margin, maybe a little bit worse, because we're seeing the payout of tariff refunds. But the, you know, deficit outlook is something in the low 6% 2% of GDP in the near term, which means the debt, you know, debt to GDP just keeps, you know, rising steadily. And there really is there's no near-term efforts to change the fiscal outlook by either party. It's just not a very high priority in the near term. So the costs politically of austerity policies, which is it's just not worth it. It's so I think the status quo is we could see modest amounts of spending cuts just that are in current law that come from the OBBBA law, just finding some pay fors, and maybe Democrats, if anything, if they gain at least one chamber of Congress, will try to delay that. So the direction of travel is really to delaying spending cuts as opposed to moving it forward. And so what does that mean? I think Fred alluded to different maneuvers the Treasury can do to try to slow the effects of of issuance by either shifting it to be a shorter maturity or just signaling that it can try to adapt to the market. And so we've seen a number of policies this year which just signal that they're going to try to lean against volatile market moves. And I think we just see more of the same, but really no fiscal policy changes that change the underlying concerning fiscal outlook. And unfortunately, something like AI adoption, which is really, I think, a big upside for the growth outlook, it doesn't come soon enough to change the fiscal outlook in the near, next few years.
Brilliant. Thanks, Andrew. Maybe, Fred, you can perhaps expand on, I guess people watching the intervention in the past week will have seen the yields came down and they sort of gone up, not all the way back to where they were, but nearly all the way back. What are some of the, aspects of the toolkit that give you some confidence that they can, get this under control?
Yeah, look, the announcement last week, as I mentioned, was an increase to their long end treasury buybacks. So prior to last week, the Treasury was conducting about $2 billion per issue of buybacks in the 10 to 30 year part of the curve. They felt it was an opportune time, given the moves that we were seeing, to intervene and essentially double the amount of those buybacks. And they've mentioned that $4 billion is at least $4 billion. So they're signaling that if they have to do more, they will. So clearly, that's a statement of intent that with the long end moving above 5%, they were getting increasingly uncomfortable. As Andrew and as I alluded to earlier said, a lot of the funding has been skewed towards the very short end, to T-bills. Now, there's a lot of natural demand for short-dated collateral, particularly out of money market funds, financial institutions. So that's actually a very smart thing to do. And also, you don't go and lock in some of these higher rates that they would have to pay if they borrowed more long-term. So I think that ultimately does help the funding situation in the long-term. They've also, a few weeks ago, there was some dollar-yen intervention. So we hadn't seen coordinated FX interventions for a very long time, but the United States and Japan felt on the 31st of July, it was the right time to do that because we had seen quite a significant depreciation in the dollar yen. So they stepped in, and off the back of that, there was some concern that if suddenly, there's stability on dollar yen, Japanese investors who have very large foreign investments may start to repatriate that back into Japan. There was some concern expressed from the Treasury that that wouldn't be a great outcome, particularly for the Treasury market, if Japan starts to liquidate Treasury. So what they're doing now is there are some FX swap facilities that were introduced during the pandemic, and they're looking at ways to reactivate those and give dollar liquidity to the Japanese official sector. Now, you got other measures around regulation. There's been ongoing talk around loosening bank regulation, making it more economic for banks to hold sovereign bonds. There's been initiatives around stable coins that hopefully can generate demand for the US collateral. So look, the list goes on. And I think the US government is obviously exploring all avenues here. At the end of the day, as we touched on before, the ultimate driver is going to be growth, inflation, and Fed policy. So, you know, we have a view that we think inflation is going to continue to gradually trend down. We don't think that the Fed is going to raise rates as what is priced into the curve at the moment. So we think ultimately that is going to be the driver of rates going forward.
Brilliant. Thank you, Fred. And I think with that, we've come to time. So we've heard about a US economy in still pretty good health, but still good opportunities in fixed income for all of the reasons Fred has described, you know, despite some of the, you know, perhaps more interventions in the markets, and then also a great picture emerging in Europe, both from a macro and a micro standpoint. So with that, I'll leave it there, and we hope you can join us again soon. Thank you.
This material has been prepared and published by the global wealth management business of UBS Switzerland AG, regulated by FINMA in Switzerland, its subsidiaries or affiliates collectively referred to as UBS. The investment views have been prepared in accordance with legal requirements designed to promote the independence of investment research. This material is for your information only and is not intended as an offer or a solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any investment or other specific product. The analysis contained herein does not constitute a personal investment recommendation or take into account the particular investment objectives, investment strategies, financial situation, and needs of any specific recipient. This material may not be reproduced or copies circulated without prior authority of UBS. Please visit www.ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer to read the full legal disclaimer applicable to this material.